I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection.
Where have you gone, Joe DiMaggio? Our nation turns its lonely eyes to you.
Joe DiMaggio is gone now. It's the nation turning its lonely eyes for comfort, for news, for sensation, for dirt that we have to worry about. Until he died last year, nearly 50 years after his retirement, Joe DiMaggio insisted on being introduced everywhere as the greatest living ball player. And even Ted Williams, the greatest hitter, didn't really want to argue with Joe. He ran the base paths and the outfield, and he gave his all every day on the thought that there might be somebody out there in the stands, as he said, who's never seen me play. Shortstop Phil Rizzuto said, you'd turn around and see him out there, and you knew you had a pretty good chance to win. That was the way ballplayers used to talk, and fans used to believe. DiMaggio was as big a star as Babe Ruth had been. He was a bigger hero than Franklin Roosevelt in the 1930s. But it's been a long time since we could let any poster hero alone. Our guest, Richard Ben Kramer, has devoted 5 years of hard digging, as only he can, and 500 pages to seeing Joe DiMaggio whole. A lot we knew about Marilyn Monroe heartbreak, about Joe's miserable record as a father and a husband, and a lot we didn't know, like the obsessive trading in signed baseballs and memorabilia, the palships and the money connections with the mob, the resentments of Mickey Mantle, Ted Williams, and anybody who made a buck off him. Paul Simon, here's where Joe DiMaggio has gone. Make the Yankee Clipper connection at 1-800-423-8255. In its grandeur and in shipwreck form with the biographer Richard Ben Kramer, 1-800-423-TALK. Or join us online at theconnection.org. Welcome back, Richard Ben Kramer, one of the great reporters of our time. Go back to, I mean, there's the good news here and the bad. Start with the good. I mean, and particularly for people who didn't watch baseball before 1950, remind us how great he was.
Well, it's nice to be back with you, Chris. You know, Joe was, above all else, a winner. Joe would do whatever it took to win. That's what he loved in the game, was to win. Joe was a guy who, probably the first guy in the history of baseball who could do everything perfectly. He could run, he could throw, he could field, he could hit, and he could hit for power. But it wasn't just how good Joe often was or the numbers he piled up. It was that he was almost never bad. You'd never see DiMaggio look bad on a low, slow curveball. You'd never see him throw to the wrong base. You'd never see him get thrown out on the base paths. Joe didn't make any mistakes, and that was the hallmark of Yankee baseball at the time. No mistakes.
Sounds like our friend Ruby Braff talking about Louis Armstrong. He said, never played a bad note once, ever.
Yeah, well, that was Joe on the ball field. You know, Joe is not credited often with how smart he was about the game. He was always called the natural. But really, I think what distinguished him was that he never did the wrong thing on the ball field. He always did the thing that was likelier to make the Yankees winners. And he really, over a 13-year career that took 16 years because he had to take time off for the war, he really was the unnatural. He stood against the humbling nature of the game. It never made him look like a bumbler as it did all mortal men.
It seems to me only Bill Russell had that, both the passion and the record of winning above all. You write about, and there are many instances of it, but his shaming Yogi Berra for not running out a hit that could have been a double. Or somebody else chewed out Yogi Berra, and Berra looked at Joe, and Joe glared at him. It was one of those things that a young ball player never, ever got over.
When Joe would give you that, what they called the look of death, you watched your step for the next 2 years. You know, Joe didn't even have to say a word. He was such an eminence in that clubhouse. And the way he was about everything he did made them all better players. He was the guy who showed them how to be Yankees.
Richard, you write so well, and I love your voice, too. I wish you'd just read a little bit about, there's a moment in the middle of the book, a description of Joe DiMaggio coming into the clubhouse, and I wish you'd just go with it.
Happy to. When Joe walked, this is from 1947, when Joe was back from the war. The Yanks were back from the war, and yet they'd had a terrible run in 46. The Red Sox won the pennant that year. And that was, of course, a terrible shame in the Bronx. And now Joe was enforcing the old Yankee way upon a new generation of kids. When Joe walked into the locker room, it was like the lights came on, as if a voice on the PA had announced, "The team is here." Of course, he was impeccable, not just in a suit and tie, but the best suit and tie in America. He had a pal from 7th Avenue who'd make the suits, whatever Joe wanted, and his tailor, of course, to put the finishing touches. And no hat might obscure the face. It was funny about that face. The same features that had seemed so sharp and outsized in 36, now he'd grown into them. They gave him distinction. A committee of artists actually named him on the list of America's 10 most interesting faces. But it wasn't just the nose, the chin. What they saw was something that had marked DiMaggio even while he was a hatchet-faced boy. It was the composure, that sufficiency in his face. He needed no one to tell him who he was. He'd stride in across the new carpeted clubhouse with the paper under his arm. If there were fellas already getting dressed, Joe wouldn't stop. Good morning, Tom," he'd say as he passed, like an executive greeting secretaries on the way to his office. By the time he had his coat hung perfectly, now it wasn't just the old metal lockers. The Yankees had new wire mesh cubicles, big like a closet. Pete Sheehy would be running with the half a cup of coffee. Joe didn't have to ask anymore. DiMaggio would sit in his undershirt with his half a cup and smoke, one leg thrown over the other. He'd open up the papers. The other players would sneak glances to see if Dago was going to say anything. They'd never talk to him first. Mostly they'd see his broad back, thick with muscle, like the withers of a racehorse. Like a dome of muscle, as one Yankee described it. Other players would filter in, attending to their rituals and chores. There was a big table in the center of the room with boxes of baseballs arrayed. Those were for the club, the owners, or some bigwigs. All the players had to sign them, except for the Dago. Pete Sheehy would sign for DiMaggio. Perfect, just like Joe's grade school script. The big guy could sit in silence till he was ready to visit the trainer, get himself taped. After that, it was BP. Joe hit first. When Joe stepped into the cage, that's when BP started. The pitchers all knew Joe wanted the ball on the inside half, pecker high. Anything else, he'd let it go by. Players on opposing teams would linger in their dugouts to watch him drive a few balls into the left field stands. Other Yankees, once they took their licks, they'd run to the outfield to shag some flies. DiMaggio would sit in the dugout shade. He knew how to catch, and he didn't need any extra throws. His arm was hurting him enough already. After BP, the Yanks would return to the clubhouse to put on fresh shirts, crisp, clean, like Yankees. Then they could come out for the game. All the players, and then DiMaggio.
Continue on to the start of the next page.
Joe came out last, so he'd be alone, his old sandlot pal, Dario Lodigiani, noticed. And all the people saying, "There goes DiMaggio. That's Joe DiMaggio." He made it a point to come out last, see? But that was part of his job, too, to be Joe DiMaggio. If he gave the Yankees back their swagger, he also taught them how to back it up. Around the All-Star break, Joe hit safely in 25 of 27 games. In one three-week stretch, he averaged .493. The Pinstripes took over first place in mid-June, and they didn't just rest there. From June 19 to July 17, DiMaggio's Yankees won 19 straight. No team had ever done that since the Cubs in the year 1906. The Yanks ran so far out in front that when his legs swelled up and started hurting, DiMaggio agreed he would sit out a week or two in the August heat. But he hated being forced to the bench. Made him feel like a cursed nobody. "I wonder if I'll ever play again," Daniel quoted Joe when the idleness got to him. "It seems as if a jinx has set out to ruin me." The Yankees clinched by September 15th. They'd finished 12 games up on Detroit, 14 games ahead of Boston. Still, in September, there was DiMaggio pounding across the grass in center field. See, it was on that field where the self-possession came to him. That was where perfection started. One time, Jimmy Cannon asked Joe why he was out there every day when the pennant was all locked up. The games didn't mean a thing. Why was he pushing himself so hard? As Cannon quoted Joe, "I always think there may be someone out there in the stands who's never seen me play."
Jimmy Cannon probably wrote that line, but it's such a wonderful line anyway. I just want to say that was the Joe DiMaggio that I grew up on. I never saw him, wasn't old enough to see him play, but the myth was alive. I read his book, Lucky to Be a Yankee. In fact, my father never let me forget. One time I applied to his school, I was probably 12 years old, and they asked, list 7 books you've read in the last year. And I gave them an honest answer. I said, I've read Lucky to Be a Yankee 7 times. question, and I want to kick it around for the rest of this hour. Why isn't that enough, Richard Ben Kramer? Why do we have to know more about our sports gods? Why did you want to know more?
Well, you know, here's how I've come to explain it. And there are a lot of fans, especially older fans, who are disturbed by the idea of a real biography of Joe because they don't want their own childhood memories jiggled with. You know, they feel like I've put under attack the memories that they've kept green and verdant in their own minds for so many years. I don't think that's what my book's about at all. I've always thought that the life of DiMaggio was so much more interesting than the myth. The myth was vast and shiny, and it did make us feel good. Joe was always one man we could look at who made us feel good. But inside that myth, once he'd embraced the hero's life, I don't think he had many happy days. It was the ruin of him, really. If you look at a life like most of us do, where you want the intimacies, the conversations, the friendships, Joe never had any of those. He spent 65 years being the Joe DiMaggio we wanted him to be. And really, that's a very tough way to live.
It's a very tough way to live, but there's a dignity in it, too, if he doesn't want to share his unhappiness.
Oh, I quite understand, Chris, and I try to give him his dignity in the book because you have to respect the grit and determination that made him hold on to that life and that image with a white-knuckled fist. I mean, nobody had a run like DiMaggio. Nobody had a life like DiMaggio, and it's very possible no one ever will again. In a country that usually chews up its heroes and spits them out in a month and a half, Joe went on for 65 years, and even on his deathbed, he had to be Joe DiMaggio. When George Steinbrenner came down to Florida to visit Joe on his deathbed, Joe had to get a fresh shirt, he had to have the barber in, he had to be shaved, he had to have his hair combed, he had to have everything perfect, because he had to be Joe DiMaggio again. And I do give him the credit for that. I think you have to see him at size. But at the same time, if we don't understand why we make heroes, if we don't understand how we make heroes and what we do to our heroes, then we don't know our own history. And that can't be.
Well, we make a lot of the wrong heroes, obviously, I mean, of the O.J. stripe, perhaps. But who's to say we made a wrong hero in Joe DiMaggio? He never let us down on the ball field. As you say, he never, wasn't just that he never threw to the wrong base, that would be understandable if he did, but he never failed to run out a hit. He never sat out a game when he could have played. Maybe that, I don't know, what's wrong with that kind of heroism?
I don't think there's anything wrong with that kind of heroism.
Well, and again, he's, by all accounts, Joe was not a bright guy, but he was smart enough to know, as Abraham Lincoln said, you know, not to speak and give away the game.
Well, Joe was actually a very canny guy, very alert, and I think quite bright. He was uneducated, and he always risked mortification if he started to talk. And he did cover what he didn't know with his silence. He had a spare and minimal elegance to his every act, not just on the baseball field, but in social situations, if he were spotted in a restaurant, Joe, with a few words, could let you know just where you stood. He was never very comfortable with words and used them seldom. He preferred to just let people look at him, and they would see what he hoped they would see was the dignity and the gravity that made him such a special figure. I don't think there's anything wrong with Joe's performance as a hero, but there is something wrong in our not knowing what the cost of the hero's life is.
What was the cost for Joe DiMaggio?
Well, Joe's determination that he would do only a few things but do each one perfectly meant that he walled away most of what we would call a normal life. The intimacies, the friendships, a family life.
Fatherhood?
Fatherhood, certainly. He had a rough time with that. He really became obsessed about what the hero's life was worth. And in his terms, he used it primarily to pile up money, millions upon millions, and to go around basically as America's guest for 60 years. We would, in fact, give him anything if he would always look like the hero we required, and that was the bargain Joe accepted.
It's a pathetic story in the end. I mean, I found it a very upsetting book, I got to tell you. The picture of him sort of renting himself out on his 80th birthday to businessmen in Reno who just wanted him to be there for $1 million, sort of between baseball signings. He needed a friend.
Yes, he needed a friend, and he never did have him. And when he did have him, his native suspicion always caused him to walk away from those friends. You know, Joe, if you knew Joe for 40 years, he was still always looking for that moment when you were going to take advantage of him. Everybody always had two strikes on him in Joe's count.
I noticed this myself. When he signed a baseball, he much preferred to sign it to Richard Ben Kramer or Christopher Lydon. He'd spell the whole thing out, not, you know, with best wishes, Joe DiMaggio, because that meant you'd sell it.
That's right. He always thought that everybody who came up for an autograph was really trying to make a buck off him. I got to tell you one story. You know, the fellow who took care of the Yankee clubhouse in Joe's latter years was named Nick. And every time the Clipper would come into the clubhouse, Nick knew he'd have to send a boy to load Joe's car up with free baseballs. Joe liked free baseballs. And so Nick would fill up the trunk of some huge Lincoln Continental or something, all with free baseballs, and that happened every time Joe showed up. One time Nick asked the friend who was escorting Joe to the spring training camp of the Yankees, he said, you know, I'd really like it if Joe would stop by and just sign a few for me that I want to give to my family and, you know, just for close friends. So the fella said, well, I'm sure that'll be no problem, Nick. You've been very good to Joe. So he talked about it with Joe, and Joe said, what do I have to sign for that bum for, you know? And he said, no, come on. This guy's been great to you, Joe. And Joe said, all right. So to make a long story short, they did finally get down to the locker room after the game, and there Nick had six balls arrayed on the table with six new Sharpie pens. Everything else cleared off. Everything was ready for the Clipper. So the Clipper grabs up the first ball. He says, Nick, nothing but the best, he writes. Second ball gets, Nick, you're the greatest, Joe DiMaggio. Third ball, Nick, we go back, Joe DiMaggio. He wrote Nick on every ball. Finally gets to the sixth ball. He writes, Nick, hope you find someone named Nick to sell these balls to.
Oh, my God. 1-800-423-8255. You spent years chasing Joe DiMaggio, hoping that he would break down and say, you've talked to everybody else now, let's you and I do it. He never broke down. The impression was he thought he was happy you were doing it because it meant he was important, but he never would speak to you about himself. Why not, do you suppose?
Well, I know very well why not. I mean, Joe's attitude toward biography went back 40 years before I came along. I mean, I tried not to take it personally because it wasn't about me. It was about that Joe never wanted anyone to look in on his life.
And he turned down an offer to write his own because they wanted more dirt on Marilyn Monroe or about that than he wanted to tell. Yeah, but any man who's, if you'd spent that much time on me, I'd want to talk to you.
Well, any normal man would, but Joe wasn't a normal man. Joe lived his life in a way that hid him away from our prying gaze. And he wasn't about to undo all that by talking to some Dewey writer who shows up in Florida and wants to write his book. You know, Joe looked at every writer, whether it was a biographer or a five-minute interview, the same way. He'd think, why should this guy make a buck off my life? In Joe's view, his life was his possession to be merchandised as he saw fit.
1-800-423-8255. The Joe DiMaggio connection. Richard Johnson is on the line, curator of the New England Sports Museum, himself the co-author of a marvelous illustrated life of Joe DiMaggio. Welcome, Richard.
How are you?
Good.
Your book is wonderful. You've filled in the gaps. I'm amazed at the detail and have enjoyed it immensely.
What did you learn, Richard, that you hadn't known?
Excuse me?
What did you learn that you hadn't known?
Just the profound sadness that seemed to stalk this man, that there was a joylessness, but just an amazing focus to his career. And his career, of course, is what we had spent most of our time with in the book that Glenn Stout and I had done. But everything else is so bizarre, and it's so, again, profoundly sad.
Did we have to learn the sadness?
Did we have to learn? Well, I think there is such a curiosity about someone who was so good at what he did. I mean, he was the best. He, in fact, he's a player whose statistics don't even come close to telling his story. You really had to have seen him. He's also a player for whom still photography does justice. There are not many players who are as classically graceful as this man was, and still photography really suited him, although he hated photographers too. So you see very few stills of him off the field because he didn't want anybody invading his space.
You know, Richard, I'm so happy to talk to you because I loved your book. The game-by-game recounting of Joe's career is the only way to see how special he was to that team and, in fact, to the whole league and the whole game through all those years.
Well, you know, it's interesting. It was the respect with which he was held by athletes from other sports. And there's an anecdote related to Boston that has everything to do with the way he is remembered here. And that was in 1949 when he had a number of ailments. And his heel spur, of course, which was dogging him. And who should come to his aid but a man who generally is considered to be one of the two or three greatest athletes in the history of Harvard, a man named George Owen, who won 9 varsity letters at Harvard and was a great all-around athlete and actually played with the Boston Bruins and was Eddie Shore's defense partner in 29 when they won the Stanley Cup. George Owen was a tinkerer. He's a very interesting guy. At various times, he'd been a teacher. He'd been a stockbroker. But he also devised any number of sports implements and inventions. And it was George Owen of Harvard University and the Boston Bruins who devised the heel cushion, a donut, that he brought to DiMaggio at the Visitors Clubhouse at Fenway Park. And somehow got through the layers, you know, you had to get through to go to get into the park, although I think for Owen it probably wasn't too hard with the reputation he had. DiMaggio used this heel cushion, the donut, and it helped Achilles defeat the Red Sox. One of our own actually helped Joe, but I think it was the esteem with which DiMaggio was held by all athletes, really, of being the supreme performer that allowed a man like George Owen to say, I think I have something that will help this man.
That's interesting. That's a beautiful story.
Well, you know, there were a number of times in Joe's career when the Fenway Park crowd rose to its feet and applauded him for who he was. I mean, even though he was in the field against them, the Fenway Park crowd recognized that here was somebody who was, embodied the great baseball that they loved.
No, and it didn't hurt that he was the brother of Dominic as well. In fact, there was one instance where Joe wore a Red Sox uniform at Fenway Park, which is interesting, because there's a photo of this, which I'm trying to find. When the Red Sox clinched in 1946, they were waiting for the Cardinals and the Dodgers to complete a three-game playoff. Red Sox played an assortment of American League All-Stars in an exhibition game. Joe's uniform somehow got lost, or it might have even been stolen. He played the entire game wearing a Boston uniform.
There was also the moment at Twitch Shores, when was it, Richard? You'd know, when Tom Yawkey and Dan Topping decided in their cups that we'll trade them.
That's right. They both got loaded and made the trade. But
Williams for DiMaggio at the wall, Williams with a short right field.
Yeah, it was actually Yawkey who woke up the next day and got cold feet because it was he who'd be breaking up a pennant winner, not the Yankees. And he thought the Boston fans might kill him.
The Boston writers, as always, would have had something to say about it, too.
That's true.
When we come back, I want to talk about not just the Joe DiMaggio, Ted Williams comparison as ballplayers, but the fact that Richard Ben Kramer wrote one of the definitive Ted Williams pieces, too, in Esquire about 15 years ago, which I dug out and reread with enormous pleasure, an utterly different phenomenon as a talker. We'll be back after a short break. The phone's 1-800-423-8255. Dick Johnson from the New England Sports Museum, thank you. Author of DiMaggio, An Illustrated Life. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the Joe DiMaggio Connection. Our guest, Richard Ben Kramer, has written what's probably going to be the definitive life, the whole life, the other life, the complete life, Joe DiMaggio seen whole. His book is called Joe DiMaggio, The Hero's Life. A lot of it is not a pretty story, and Joe DiMaggio did not cooperate in it. I just want to take you back to a piece you wrote in Esquire in 1986 in a marvelous book magazine I've always saved several issues on the American Mail at mid-century, and yours was the great piece in it about Ted Williams in Florida, fishing, ranting, living a full life and talking a mile a minute with you, quizzing you, throwing his own book at you. Did you read the book? Do you want to know this? Let's take a ride. Talk about those differences. They were both so similar in a way on the ball field, perfectionist, driven, and so different off.
Well, you know, Joe would have argued with the statement that they were similar on the ball field. Ted was actually a very generous man when it came to appraising the talents of other players. And he always said DiMaggio was the greatest player of their age. Said it without reservation and without apparent jealousy. Joe, on the other hand, was jealous of Williams his whole life. It galled him more and more as he went on that when people thought of hitting 400, they thought of Williams and not him.
Could have made it, he said, if they'd... He could have hit 400 himself if he'd been played differently, he thought.
Well, so he could have. He was hitting better than, I think, 412 in 1939, as September 1939 began, but he got an infection in his eye and his average dropped 30 points in a month. And the manager, Joe McCarthy, wouldn't sit him down and let him rest the eye. McCarthy said, I wouldn't want people to think you were a cheese champion. So Joe's average finished at 388 that year, and that galled him for the rest of his life. But Joe was even, you know, Joe was awful about Williams among his own coterie. He'd say, sure he can hit. He'd say about Williams. But he throws like a broad and he runs like a ruptured duck. which was, of course, unfair to Ted. Ted was a hell of a ball player all around, too, although he was known and famed as a hitter. The thing about Ted and Joe that has always interested me is why Ted, who was also a difficult eminence in the clubhouse, became known as Teddy Tantrum and Terrible Ted and was reviled as a problem child and a selfish ball player, when Joe, who was as difficult as Ted and more so, who was narrower, greedier, and altogether impossible, was always celebrated as the gentleman's gentleman and as classy off the field as he was on. I think it's more the difference between Boston and New York. In New York, the business of the writers was to make heroes. They were an arm of the Yankee mythology, and they played along for 20 years.
What is that Williams personality, that outrageous, expressive, noisy, garrulous? As you said, he wanted to be famous, but he didn't want to be a celebrity. He was but a very open guy. He rooted for every great young ball player who had a shot at 400. He loves Nomar Garciaparra. He rooted for Rod Carew. He loved Errol Garner, the pianist, John Updike, the writer. He was not an intellectual, but he loved people who did things brilliantly well. What does all that tell you about Joe DiMaggio by negative?
By comparison? Well, Ted was...
And DiMaggio, who couldn't bear Mickey Mantle in his own center field either.
Ted was a generous and large-hearted man, also a very curious man. When Ted wanted to know something, he would shake all the change out of your pockets until he knew what you knew about it. When Ted went after a subject, he's relentless. And he went after a lot of subjects. There was nothing he couldn't know if he set his mind to it. Joe never wanted to be thought deficient, to be thought clumsy, or to look stupid. So he wouldn't ask about anything he didn't know. He professed to know everything he talked about. Joe never had opinions, only certainties. And you couldn't tell him anything about any ball player or any subject at all. At the same time, he walled away most subjects because he knew he wasn't competent in them. So Joe was a much narrower character from start to finish. Joe's primary interest was Joe.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Richard Ben Kramer Joe DiMaggio connection, or 1-800-423-TALK, or join us online at theconnection.org. The last half of this life is not a happy one, and it's not a pretty picture, Richard Ben Kramer. I want you to tell it, and again, why you felt it had to be part of the story. Why you feel deeply that it's a more interesting story than the legend? There's the mob. There are endless women. There are pals. There are lonely nights. There's money. There's the Bowery Savings Bank. There's an obsessiveness about what's in it for Joe.
Right. Well, you know, Chris, I think that what's interesting about Joe's life is the huge swath he was able to cut through the last century, starting with a set of tools that were, you know, focused very narrowly. I mean, he was great on the ball field. But he became much more than a baseball player to us. Joe's very blankness allowed us to invest in him just the values we wanted at that time. In the 30s, when he came up, he was the immigrant boy who made it big, and that was the story America needed to hear. In 1941, as the war was looming, Joe was our poster boy for victory and valor, getting hits every day in his famous 56-game streak. After the war, when we were rich and at ease and prosperous as we'd never been, Joe was our first Broadway Joe, squiring Miss America's to the Stork Club with all the elegance and grace and the supposed God-given gifts of power and dignity that with which America herself
and had virility. Been
impressed. And virility, that's right. And when he married Marilyn Monroe in 1954, of course, he added the the Kleeglites of Hollywood to the aura around him, and there was the whole pile, and then there was Joe on top. There was nobody like him. He was our Mr. America. But he understood, even at that time, he understood very early in his life that it was always about how we felt with Joe. You know, it was always how we felt good when he was with us. Joe DiMaggio, we want you on our side. And he came to think of every new acquaintance as somebody else who was going to take advantage of him, or every conversation as an attempt to mortify him somehow. He was very suspicious by nature. He was trained that way in his family. His dad, Giuseppe DiMaggio, was not a church-going man, for instance, not because he disliked the mass or the priests, but because confession wasn't for him. He wouldn't tell his sins to any man. And Joe grew up the same way. Joe was not going to show his life to us. Joe was not going to share his life to us. He shrank from our gaze for 60 years. He wanted everything that the hero's life was worth, but he wasn't going to give of himself. And in the end, we celebrated him as much as anything else for his mystery. He never gave himself entirely to us, and in that we saw dignity and saw some hearkening back to a better age.
Everybody's a sort of amateur Freudian these days. Do you have a theory about why, what formed that personality?
Everybody's an amateur Freudian except me. I don't go in much for that, but I do know that it started so early with Joe, that inwardness, that self-possession and almost exclusive self-interest, that you're almost tempted to think it's genetic. Certainly he was not changed by the upbringing he received at home.
Except genes are one thing, but his brothers are very different.
That's true. Vince, for instance, his older brother, who was the first DiMaggio to go into baseball, was a very happy-go-lucky fella. He was a great talker, and when he wasn't talking, he sang. Dominic DiMaggio, who was the great center fielder of the Red Sox for so many years, was a very smart and very successful man in the rest of his life. He married well, he raised a nice family, he ran a big business, and ended up, I think, in a much happier state than his big and more famous brother, Joe.
1-800-423-8255, the DiMaggio Connection with Richard Ben Kramer. Albert is calling from East Providence, Rhode Island.
Yes, hello.
Hello, Albert.
Yes, how are you?
Good.
Both of you. A quick story and then a question. Mr. Ben Kramer may know the story from Leo DeRocher's autobiography or semi-autobiography. A year or two after Marilyn Monroe died, a friendly newsman or sports reporter asked DiMaggio, said, "Joe, I just have one question. What was it like to take a shower with Marilyn Monroe?" And Joe smiled and paused and said, "Louis, you should have been there."
That was Louis Effret, Joe's great friend. I do know the story, and that Leo DeRocher book is a delight to read, isn't it? Nice Guys Finish Last?
It is wonderful. Nice Guys Finish Last wasn't quite what he said, is that right?
That's true, yeah, but nevertheless, he was prepared to live with it. It sold a lot of books.
Right. The other question is it true that he never reconciled with Ted Williams? They never broke bread together to the end?
Well, that's not exactly true, because in the latter years, when Joe and Ted were often asked to appear together, Joe and Ted came to a modus vivendi. They got along fine. There was never any problem from Ted's point of view, but Joe was able to suppress his resentment of Ted and appear with him at baseball's tribal functions. He even visited Ted's museum at the opening, the Ted Williams Museum in Central Florida. But, afterward he would have to vent his spleen on Ted among his own crowd. One of the more interesting meetings they had together was George Bush, the elder, brought them both to the White House to give them a couple of medals, something, one of the medals the president can hand out, Medal of Freedom or something like that. And Bush was such a baseball fan that although the medal ceremony was a noon event in the Rose Garden, he invited them both for breakfast so they could sit around and talk baseball all morning. And I think Bush enjoyed it a lot more than either Joe or Ted, but they all had a pretty good time that day.
Albert, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Dave is on the line.
Yeah, hi. There's something deeply contradictory about in your characterization of... Hello?
Yeah, we're there, Dave.
Yeah, hi. Something deeply contradictory in your characterization of DiMaggio. On the one hand, profoundly profound sense of self-possession. On the other hand, profoundly, apparently insecure. I mean, it just doesn't jibe. Maybe what you mean, and this is, I'm putting this in the form of a question, is that because his athletic abilities were so profound, he was self-possessed on the field. But the man you describe is anything but self-possession means you don't care what in large part or in significant part you don't care what people think of you. You're not bothered by you're not threatened by someone else's.
Richard,
I think I understand your question. What I mean to say, and maybe I haven't said it well in front of this microphone, is that Joe had a sufficiency unto himself. He didn't need anybody else to tell him who he was. He wasn't particularly interested in anything outside of himself. At the same time, he was very insecure. He thought that if he extended himself to be the sized personality that we wanted from him, that he would inevitably come to woe. He would be seen as something less. His image would be eroded. He had a kind of a way of limiting our view of him with the same kind of minimalist elegance that he always displayed on the ball field.
Dave, thank you. Alcine is calling from Memphis, Tennessee.
Yes, great show. I'm enjoying it.
Thank you.
I wanted to point out, you were talking about the difference and something I remembered about Ted Williams. It was either 1957 or 1958. They were, to me, Joe DiMaggio wanted to meet the expectations, what he knew his fans and the public expected of him. And on the other hand, I don't think Ted Williams cared that much. He spat on a reporter, either 1957 or 1958. And, of course, it was a big hullabaloo. They wanted an apology. The reporter was going to sue. I don't remember, you know, all I remember was that definitely he was unhappy with the reporter about something. What I'm saying is that's something that Joe DiMaggio or wouldn't have thought of doing, was spitting at a reporter.
I think that's true, Alcine. You know, Joe always comported himself in the way he would want to be shown. And that was a big difference with Ted. Ted would rather show the reporter exactly what he thought of him. Joe couldn't have cared less. He simply wouldn't talk to the man for the rest of his life. The same way how they would appear publicly. Ted never liked ties and wouldn't wear a tie, no matter what was the occasion. Joe not only wouldn't emerge from his house without his suit and tie, but it had to be the best suit and tie in America.
1-800-423-8255. Keith is calling from Watertown, New York.
Yes, hello.
Hi, Keith.
Hi. I'm intrigued by the program and have to confess I was born in 1960. Really don't know too much about Joe DiMaggio or baseball, except for the Mr. Coffee commercials and except for, you know, the reference in a popular song by Simon and Garfunkel about "Here's to You, Joe DiMaggio." So would the author comment on those two, you know, other aspects of this fellow being an American icon?
I think that's a good question, because Joe was much more than baseball. Joe found a way to sit atop the great national pile through decade after decade. And one of the ways he found was that he became a TV icon in the 70s as the spokesman for the Bowery Bank in New York and then nationwide for Mr. Coffee. Joe never was comfortable on TV, but those were scripted spots that he could do 100 times until they were perfect. And he would do them 100 times. They'd be there all day. After which Joe would scoop up all the coffee makers they'd used in the shoot and all the cheese platters and everything else that was in the studio and put it in the trunk of his car, or have it put in the trunk of his car. But, you know, what Joe found about being on TV was what a generation of politicians found at the same time. With TV, with a million screens, a million times, that repetition over and over, not only could you create your own image and enforce it, but people stopped asking you about anything else. They didn't ask him so much about Marilyn Monroe or about the Yankees or his playing career or Mickey Mantle or anything else. They just wanted him to be that guy on TV. And so in the end, it was a very comfortable remove for Joe. And of course, he didn't mind the money either.
1-800-423-8255. James is calling from Williamsville, New York.
Great show.
Thank you, James.
Every morning.
Pleasure.
And Joe DiMaggio was probably the best player of his era, but I'm sorry, he can't compare with Ty Cobb.
Make the case fast.
That's it.
Well, you know, it's interesting that Joe was always called the heir to Babe Ruth, but that had much more to do with the needs of the Yankees and the needs of the New York writers than it did with how Joe played. In fact, Joe was much closer to Cobb, and Cobb took an interest in Joe's career when he was a young boy and a minor leaguer. Cobb had retired in California, and he used to watch Joe and advise Joe. And Joe was much more like Cobb. I think you have expressed an opinion with which Cobb would have agreed. He didn't think anybody could compare to him. But he did recognize in DiMaggio a worthy successor and a ball player to be valued and taught.
You know, you don't quote one of my favorite lines about Joe DiMaggio. George Frazier, late columnist in the Boston Herald and Globe, had this little device, duende. He wrote about duende, a Spanish word, sort of a dark magic, sort of an awareness of death. Sort of, he would call it the nth degree, or beyond the nth degree of style and grace. And he used it in this way about DiMaggio. He said, DiMaggio, in center field, late of an afternoon, racing to the wall, catching a fly ball that he couldn't see with his back to the plate, that was the nth degree of grace and style. But when Joe DiMaggio threw Peter Lawford out of Marilyn Monroe's funeral, that was duende.
That's great.
We haven't spoken enough about the Marilyn years, the Marilyn story that didn't end at all with their divorce, didn't end really till Joe DiMaggio's death. What's the Kramer version in the last minute here?
Well, you know, I think what people mistook about Joe and Marilyn was they thought that it was they had nothing in common. It was nothing but a sexual attraction gone wrong. In fact, what I try to point out to people is that they had the biggest thing in common. They were both living inside these giant creations of the hero machine. And when they found each other, it was like brother and sister. They really had the deepest bond together.
It's a marvelous book, Richard Ben Kramer, Joe DiMaggio, The Hero's Life. Thank you, Richard. Thank you for the book, and thank you for joining us. Thanks also to Richard Johnson, curator of the New England Sports Museum in Boston and co-author of DiMaggio, An Illustrated Life. You can continue the DiMaggio conversation on our website at theconnection.org. Thanks for help today from John Hoder, Tad Curry, Lydia Moland, David McMahon, Tim Monroe, Darren Manoogian, and Kim Bichari. The Connection is produced by Catherine Bidwell, Dan First, Hitesh Hatti, Amy McDonald, Jake Shapiro, Keith Shields, and Will Smith. Mary McGrath is our Yankee Clipper. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston.
He lived in baseball's Hall of Fame. He got there blow by blow. Our kids will tell their kids his name, Joltin' Joe DiMaggio.
We dream of Joey with the light brown back.
Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.